There?
I am. Can
okay,
you hear me?
Good. Phew. You know, the challenge is, people don't understand listening. There's one button here on this phone, and it is just so hard to push, and it happens to be the VIP line.
You need to do those thumb exercises.
I'm telling you, I need to do like that kung fu where you poke a board like 10,000 times so you can, man. All right, Connor, so without any further ado, what is it that you wanted to discuss today?
Well, it's been a nice reprieve with Hurricane Sandy. I mean, people have died. There's been some destruction. There's a lot of damage that's going on. There's a lot of bad things happening. One of the silver linings in the cloud that I've seen is that all of the talking heads and the news media has stopped focusing 24/7 on the presidential election.
Yeah.
Right, there's been a nice reprieve, a temporary abatement from the silliness of, you know, who's golfing where and who said what at which private luncheon and who cares. And so that's been nice. There's a lot of coverage about what's going on. And what's been interesting is to see some of the political and economic stuff that's begin to come out, because there's a pattern that emerges. There are things that happen after any significant natural disaster that you see the political and economic class start to advance. And one of the interesting ones that I found quite unexpected in terms of its the quickness with which it was published was an editorial by the New York Times that was published yesterday. Right, so here's the New York Times. All these websites in New York are going out that have their data centers in New York. These websites are going down because, you know, people's server rooms are flooding, and there's all this stuff going on in New York. But here you have the New York Times taking the opportunity to publish an editorial basically attacking Mitt Romney for not loving FEMA. So Mitt Romney throughout the campaign has said, you know, we need to turn some of this stuff back to the states. FEMA's problematic. We should push this back down constitutionally to where it belongs. And so while Hurricane Sandy is devastating parts of New York, you have the New York Times turning this into a political attack to go after those who have claimed that that, you know, government isn't the solution. In fact, the title that they chose was "A Big Storm Requires Big Government," and of course, their theory, their main allegation is that we need big government programs and spending to counteract the destruction that comes in the wake of something like a Hurricane Sandy. And so you see these political and economic. That was a political one. This is definitely a political attack going after Romney, but you see economic ones as well. And you see this, as I said, almost without fail, any significant disaster, you'll get at least one, if not multiple, mainstream economists coming out and advancing an argument that is almost verbatim each and every time, one that has long been debunked, one that is completely foolhardy, and yet that news media and others regurgitate without controversy and without any criticism. And that is the allegation that destruction is a net positive for the economy, that because of what's happening, people will spend money, and therefore the long-term economic outlook is positive. We've seen this already. I've taken note of a few examples with Hurricane Sandy. Just moments ago, I think about an hour or two ago, Shepard Smith on Fox News was talking about the infusion of cash that will come from the recovery, the spending that will come in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, and praising that oh, we're going to have this infusion of cash, and what a good thing that will be. There's an economist by the name of Peter Maricki, the Smith School of Business, University of Maryland. He published an article, I believe it was this morning, it was just a few hours ago, about 4 hours ago, basically saying that, you know, not all bad news, that the economic impact of Hurricane Sandy has an upside. He says, disasters can give the ailing construction sector a boost and unleash smart reinvestment that actually improves stricken areas and the lives of those that survive intact. Ultimately, Americans, he writes, as they always seem to do, will emerge stronger in the wake of disaster and rebuild better making and brighter future in the face of tragedy. You know, he says that he goes on to project some of the billions that are estimated to be involved with insurance claims and construction recovery spending, you know, in the tens of billions of dollars. And throughout this article, he says that ultimately this is a wonderful thing. People are going to rebuild bigger and better than ever. They're going to be spending this money that's going to be infused into the markets. And if you take a very superficial view of the economy and how money transfer occurs, then that argument makes sense, right? I mean, because look at all this money that people may have been sitting on or saving, and now they're going to hire construction workers who are going to be able to feed their families and pay grocers who are then able to pay for their kids' education. and you get this trickle effect of money. So it sounds good superficially. It sounds that it might work. But it's not true. Like I said a few moments ago, and as you well know, as many of your listeners I'm sure know, this is what Frederick Bastiat called the broken window fallacy. So this has been debunked for at least two centuries, and many other, you know, free market economists since then have likewise taken exception to this consistent claim that is made in the wake of disaster. I mentioned a couple examples. There's another one, you know, this guy named Paul Ashworth, chief U.S. economist at Capital Economics, said that while the initial, and this is published in the Telegraph, British paper, that while the initial impact of the storm on the economy could be quite large, when the cleanup is taken into consideration, the overall impact on GDP growth could even be positive. And he goes on to explain how this can be, and he's advancing the same claim. All of this spending that will be unleashed to rebuild and reconstruct is a wonderful thing. Well, you know, this is the broken window fallacy. This is what Frederick Bastiat, 2.5 centuries ago, basically debunked with a very simple explanation that if a boy breaks a window, of course the shopkeeper will have to pay the glazier to get new glass, and that trickle effect will occur. Well, what Frederick Bastiat attacks in his essay titled That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen is that that transaction is what's seen. What we don't see is that had that money not been spent on the window, it would have been spent somewhere else. He would have bought a bouquet of flowers for his wife. He would have expanded his office or what have you. The money would have been spent. The question is, do we want to have a net increase of wealth, or do we want to be destroying things for the specific effect of then rebuilding them? Are we going to spend our capital, our labor and time on simply rebuilding what already existed, therefore not having a net increase in wealth? Sure, we'll have GDP. Sure, we'll have income. But that's not how you measure the wealth and progress of society. So in Frederick Bastiat's example with the broken window, there is a net negative. Society has a net loss of one window, even though the spending occurred, whereas it could have had a net gain of the bouquet of flowers or something else.
Yeah, this is a general concept known as opportunity cost in your basic economics classes.
And
that, that money could have been spent to something else instead of went to go, you're putting out fires instead of putting a forward motion.
Oh, that's exactly right. In fact, I love Bob Murphy's example of it. He says, you know, if your neighbor's lounging at a pool and you set his house on fire, he'll definitely work harder. He'll have to spend his money to rebuild, but you haven't made him any richer, right? You haven't done him any favor by saying, oh, but look how wonderful this is going to be. You're going to be able to rebuild even bigger and better and spend money and hire people. It's a net negative. When you apply it personally to individual circumstances, it's clearly recognized as being a fallacy. The problem is that people don't make that same application at a societal level to say the same pattern exists, that if there is destruction, it is not a positive thing. That money should have and could have been allocated differently.
Yeah, it's positive maybe for some people, but on net, it's still destructive. You've still pulled value out of the system at large.
That's exactly right. And the unfortunate thing here is, as you said, you know, opportunity cost, these have very basic economic principles, and you would think that economists, by and large, would understand this. And yet it is astounding that so many of the economists, mainstream economists, either do not understand or they completely reject this simple, commonsensical approach and understanding to economic interactions between individuals or, you know, in the aggregate, society at large. This is something, and I have other examples to share after the break as well, this is not unique to Hurricane Sandy. Time and time again, this argument is being made by the economist class, whether it's because it helps line their pockets and give more, you know, hire more economists to say these type of things or what have you. But it makes no sense, and yet economists continue to cling to it.
All right, guys, come on back. The Boyack Review, we're talking about the broken window fallacy. Guys, come on back. Mental self-defense. K-Talk. We'll see you then. All right, guys, welcome back. Mental Self-Defense Radio. I am Jake Shannon. We're in the middle of the Boyack Review. We got Connor Boyack on the line going after mainstream economists that are trying to turn this natural disaster into an excuse for big government. Connor, are you still with us?
I am. You know, and as we mentioned before the break, as I was saying and as we'll now discuss a bit more, this is a pattern. This is not something that should be seen as new with Hurricane Sandy. It's not surprising that the economist class is suddenly claiming that destruction is a net positive for the economy. In fact, I remember one of the first times that I personally encountered the fallacy was in 2007. So I'm from San Diego, and there were, in 2007, some really ravishing fires, specifically in the area of San Diego that I live in, or grew up in, I should say. And, you know, numerous neighbors and friends were having to abandon their homes. Many of them lost their homes altogether. There were very, very bad fires, and there were more than one of them. And so that had a lot of attention in 2007. It got national attention, definitely, but it was a huge, huge thing, and then still is. People are still recovering and rebuilding and trying to get over the impact of those fires. And this was a time in my life when I was just starting to kind of really understand economics. I had done a lot of political study. I was kind of waking up to, you know, the way things are in politics in general, the proper role of government and liberty and such. But I was really kind of getting a deeper education. This was about 2007 in economics. And I remember encountering an article in the LA Times that was reporting on some economists and their commentary on the destruction that was being caused from the San Diego fires. And I had read enough enough Mises and Hayek and some of these other figures to understand. And I had started reading Bastiat as well, more importantly, where I was able to note the fallacy that was being advanced, the same one that we're talking about here with Hurricane Sandy. So, for example, the LA Times, this is late 2007, it was about the same time of the year, in fact, so it was about 5 years ago, and they write that, you know, in fact, some observers see a boon to areas such as construction, which is now down 30,000 jobs through September, a 3% decline from the previous year. And then this guy from University of San Diego, an economist there, was quoted as saying, in the odd nature of economic accounting, this will probably be a stimulus. There will be a huge amount of rebuilding in the next couple of years financed by insurance payments. And they go on to quote other related economists and things, basically still advancing the same argument. So here it was on a personal nature. My neighbors, my friends, their homes are burning. And you get some talking head economist quoted in a paper saying, what a wonderful thing this is. It's going to be a net positive, and look at all the money that will be spent. Well, first of all, on an individual basis, this isn't at all reassuring. Someone lost their home, their valuable possessions. Money can't replace anything like that. And so that is a net negative, clearly, when there are things that money simply cannot replace. But looking at simply the tangible items that can be repurchased and rebuilt, is it a net positive thing? Well, so let's take it back from those fires in 2007 back to 9/11, right? Here you have massive destruction, loss of life, but just, you know, World Trade Center, the towers, the area, there's massive destruction. A lot of people are having a lot of problems. And then you get perhaps the most notorious talking head economist of them all. Can you guess who I'm going to, Jake?
Yes, Paul Krugman.
Krugman, yeah. Is it Krugman or Krugman?
I have no idea. I really try to keep his name out of my mouth as much as possible.
Yeah, I don't know and I don't care. But so Paul Krugman, you know, he's a New York Times columnist, so he's given a loud soapbox upon which to proclaim his Keynesian economic ideas. Despite being challenged by free market economist Bob Murphy for almost a year, I mean, it's probably over a year now, a standing commitment to have a public debate on Keynesian versus Austrian economics to be recorded, to be live streamed, the proceeds of which will all be donated to the New York City Food Bank, Krugman continues to refuse to a debate to have his ideas challenged in the open. In fact, there's some funny articles you can go back and read on Krugman's articles at the New York Times, in which he is challenged, and it's actually kind of both humorous and awkward. You can easily Google and find some of these examples. So he basically tries to just push his propaganda. And as I noted, the New York Times itself, within, what, hours or in the actual event of Hurricane Sandy happening, right, they published this yesterday, and then last night they bore the brunt of the attack. So Hurricane Sandy is impending upon New York. You get the New York Times writing their political attack, their political advocacy as it relates to Hurricane Sandy and emergency recovery spending with FEMA. Here you have Paul Krugman, September 14th, 2001, right? So 9/11 happened in New York, and not 3 days later, 72 hours have not passed until you get Paul Krugman publishing an article on the New York Times in which he basically tries to advance, or not tries, he does advance the same arguments that we're talking about. 9/11, the aftermath is still going on. Of course, 9/12 was the big day of unity and coming together. 9/13, we're still asking questions. 9/14, he publishes this article, and he says, it seems almost in bad taste to talk about dollars and cents after an act of mass murder. Nonetheless, we must ask about the economic aftershocks from Tuesday's horror. And then he says, these aftershocks need not be major. Ghastly as it may seem to say this, the terror attack, like the original Day of Infamy, which brought an end to the Great Depression, he says, could even do some economic good. And so then he talks about how he goes on to say the direct economic impact of the 9/11 attacks will probably not be that bad, and there will potentially be some favorable effects. And he goes on to list what those are. This is a very economically opportunistic approach to take a crisis. It's kind of the, what's the guy's name, the Obama helper that said you got to take advantage of all the crises.
Yeah, Rahm Emanuel,
thank you. And it's a very opportunistic approach to these emergencies where you say, no, but this is a good thing. Yes, there's suffering, and yes, there's problems, but this is going to be a wonderful thing overall. Well, no, it's not. You know, and one of the things that he listed is a continual argument that he advances specifically, but Keynesians generally, that World War II brought an end to the Great Depression. This is their model example by which they can try to justify their arguments that a massive infusion of spending, whether government spending or whether insurance payments and private spending as a result of a natural disaster, for example, can bring in an economic positive to what otherwise would be a negative. And there's a great link I would encourage all your listeners to go to. Tom Woods, in fact, just I think yesterday, if not the day before, published a video where he addresses this exact argument, where he basically says, no, World War II did not help the economy. It is the free market, or really commonsensical and obvious approach to what actually happened. And so you can find that article, that YouTube, at libertyclassroom.com/war. And so there Tom Woods talks about how World War II, he debunks what Krugman is saying, what these Keynesians continue to claim. World War II did not help the economy. And he has a wonderful link posted below his. It was Professor Robert Higgs. A few years ago, I think, he gave an address that he attacked this as well, where he makes the claim that war causes misery, not prosperity. And he advances the same argument as Tom Woods, the free market economist. Bastiat supported view that this is a net negative, it is not a net positive, and the Keynesians, like Paul Krugman, who continue to claim that this is in any way a net positive, and therefore we should encourage things, really need to read and see these videos, libertyclassroom.com/war. And before I kind of get off Krugman's case, I have a video for you if you've got that loaded up. It's just a minute and a half, and this video, perhaps better than many others, shows, if you'll pardon the word, the stupidity with which these economic views are advanced in the public sector to justify massive spending as somehow being a net positive, an economic good that we should do. So if you've got that, this is an interview. Paul Krugman and another economist are talking about how this government spending, this infusion of cash, is ultimately a good thing for an economic slump. So go ahead and play that.
Infrastructure spending, if it were well spent, that's great. I'm all for that. I'd borrow for that, assuming we're not paying Boston big dig kind of prices for the infrastructure.
But even if you were, wouldn't John Maynard Keynes say that if you could employ people to dig a ditch and then fill it up again, that's fine. They're being productively employed. They pay taxes. So maybe Boston's big dig was just fine after all.
Think about World War II, right? That was actually negative social product spending, and yet it.
And by the way, this whiny voice guy is Paul.
This is Krugman, yep.
Bust out. I mean, partly because you want to put these things together. If we say, look, we could use some inflation. Ken and I are both saying that, which is, of course, anathema to a lot of people in Washington, but is in fact what the basic logic says. It's very hard to get inflation in a depressed economy. But if you had a program of government spending plus an expansionary policy by the Fed, you could get that. So if you think about using all of these things together, you could accomplish, you know, a great deal. I mean, if we discovered that space aliens were planning to attack, and we needed a massive buildup to counter the space alien threat, and really inflation and budget deficits took secondary place to that, this slump would be over in 18 months. And then if we discovered, whoops, we made a mistake, there aren't actually any space aliens.
So we need Orson Welles, what you're saying.
No, there was a Twilight Zone episode like this in which scientists fake an alien threat in order to achieve world peace. Well, this time we don't need it. We need it in order to get some fiscal stimulus.
Yeah, I guess maybe they should start calling this his brand, this Keynesianism, Twilight Zone Economics.
Twilight Zone, I love that. We should start branding that. set up a website for it.
A website, just post all of Krugman's videos on
it. Just have it redirect to John Maynard Keynes Wikipedia article. But this, I think, does show the stupidity, if you'll pardon the word, for how these economic views have to be advanced, or the logical conclusion of them, that any type of spending is good, that if we can scare people or embrace destructive activities, natural disasters, man-made destructive activity, what have you, as an opportunity to spend money, that is a net positive thing. This is typical, this is tried and true John Maynard Keynes, basically saying whatever you got to do, prime the pump, spend money, get people working, have full employment. And so these are the type of arguments that really need to be understood if they're to be counteracted. Perhaps it's not so much having the blame on the Keynesians as it is having the blame on us free marketeers who have not sufficiently advanced our ideas in the public eye to have the chattering class, have the masses really understand and recognize these fallacies. The broken window fallacy, you read Bastiat's article, that which is seen and that which is unseen. It's a very simple article, it's easy to understand, and it gets to the focal point of exactly what is going on, what these economists are advancing, and why they're wrong. And so we need to better hone our skills and our arguments and craft them in such a way that we can be effective against the Krugmans and these other people who have a soapbox to advance their Keynesian ideas. I remember one year, about 4 or 5 years ago, I talked to a gal who had just recently majored in economics. And she knew Keynes, but she had no clue what Austrian economists were. She couldn't name any. She didn't understand the argument.
This was simply the challenge, because, you know, I've worked professionally with these people. I've made a lot of money with these people, too, and they're good people. And I've gone to school and seen what the curriculums are like. And, people don't have... People who come to libertarianism outside of academia, which is the norm, it's very seldom you come to it from inside, but
right.
They don't understand actually how good you have it not being, because you'll fail your exams. You will fail out of school if you don't jump through the hoops and give the Keynesian answers. It's just
right.
How it is.
Which I think is another arrow in the quiver for looking for alternative education methods to really understand the truth. I've had the great opportunity to work with Tom Woods on the website I mentioned earlier, libertyclassroom.com, and what he's trying to do there is build up a Austrian economist, libertarian, free market, true history kind of website with all sorts of educational materials, videos primarily, audio, PowerPoints and things as well, and recommended readings, so that those who either are in this educational system that we're talking about can counteract those ideas that they're getting in the classroom with the truth, or completely abandon that system altogether and pursue, you know, a true education, really trying to understand things. He's got a course on there called Austrian Economics Step by Step. And I would love to see, like, a Paul Krugman, you know, sat down and subjected to watching this type of thing. It's with Jeff Herbiner, who unfortunately, in my view, is a little bit dry. I would love a Bob Murphy or someone who's very dynamic and can convey their ideas really persuasively and in a fun manner. But this educational content is fantastic, because the problem here is that it's not just economics, it's politics as well. For example, anytime you get the intertwining of government involvement in an economic argument, it's political. Back to Hurricane Sandy is a prime example of what I'm trying to get at with this, is you have New Jersey Governor Chris Christie threatening price gougers with stiff penalties. And, of course, I need to put air quotes around price gougers, because it's simply the market responding to supply and demand. And so you have the political application or a response, a reaction to an economic matter, right? You have a governor saying that, well, you're charging too much, therefore I'm going to, through executive fiat, impose upon you a price ceiling. We had this throughout World War II.
Yeah,
we need
right.
to understand
the difference is
recognize.
They're looking at a violent answer to a peaceful situation.
Right.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Great, great, timely segment. Connor, every Tuesday, the Boyack Review right here, Mental Self-Defense, guys. Thanks, Connor.
Yep.